Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's our very first Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Very first of the new year, 2019. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dennis Goldford today, professor and chair of political science at Drake University in Des Moines, in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Dennis.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and to Kedron Bardwell as well. He's a professor and chair of political science at Simpson College. Joining us by phone, I believe. Kedron, hi.
Good to be with you again, Ben.
And happy new year to you, Kedron, and all of our political junkies out there. We'll jump into 2019. Has all the makings for being as interesting or more interesting than the politics of 2018. We'll see. But I doubt you disagree with that. Let's talk about what's happening right now. Later in the program, just as a preview, we'll talk about the controversy over the president's announced withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria and his evolution on that withdrawal. Also, toward the end of the hour, what were the most important political stories of 2018 for you, and which do you think will have the most import for 2019? We want to bat that around a bit as well. But first, gentlemen, I'm reading the latest on the shutdown over the president's demand for a wall, meeting his cabinet today, this morning, on the 12th day of this partial government shutdown. So far, we have no end in sight. Mr. Trump telling members of his cabinet he thinks they can work with Democrats. Later today, evidently, he'll be meeting with top Republicans and Democrats in the Situation Room. I guess this would be the Democratic leader's first visit to the White House since December 11th. Dennis, that was when the president said he would be proud to shut down the government for border security. Why has this been so intractable up to this point, Dennis?
This is President Trump's signature issue. And, of course, part of the persona he wants to project is the idea that this is a guy that's tough and will not back down. And this is not a president with any particular policy agenda other than the belief that the U.S. is beginning a raw deal from alliances, military and diplomatic, and from trade. But the only really solid policy concern he articulated during his entire campaign was this issue of illegal immigration. So for him, this is that core issue. And I think he and particularly his hardlining advisor, Stephen Miller, who's very much a hardliner in this regard, I think they will believe that they will undercut his base support, that rock solid support, if in some way he goes back on this particular promise, even though apparently the promise that Mexico would pay for the wall is gone out the window.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to hear a little bit of the president's comment on this issue. Speaking with reporters from his office, this is the day after Christmas, the president said he didn't know when the federal government shutdown would end, but made clear his condition.
I can't tell you when the government's going to be open. I can tell you it's not going to be open until we have a wall, a fence, whatever they'd like to call it. I'll call it whatever they want.
Okay. The president also went on to say that furloughed federal workers had reached out to him to tell him they support his demand.
The people of this country want border security. You know, it's not a question of me. I'd rather not be doing shutdowns. I've been at the White House, and I love the White House, but I wasn't able to be with my family. I thought it would be wrong for me to be with my family. My family's in Florida, Palm Beach, and I just didn't want to go down and be there when other people are hurting. But it's going to all work out. But many of those workers have said to me and communicated, stay out until you get the funding for the wall. These federal workers want the wall.
Okay, that's a claim that federal employee union representatives have denied. They say federal workers, in their words, unequivocally oppose using shutdowns as a means of resolving policy disputes. Your thoughts initially on this, Kedron, this wall shutdown?
Well, I think the president needs to be working from a position where he can actually realistically get some of the goals that he wants, and that would require, number one, a legislative strategy, some idea of, well, here's where the votes will come from for a particular proposal, and that hasn't really been mapped out yet, and he actually has less leverage now than he did last year on this issue, given the Democratic takeover in the House. And so he's undercut his own leverage by, number one, promising that Mexico would pay for it, and on the other side, saying that he wouldn't blame Schumer, and now he is blaming Schumer. I think, you know, if he had more public opinion support for this proposal, maybe he could find some way of compromise. But support for the wall has actually been declining by about 10% over the last year or two, particularly when you frame it as, well, Mexico is not going to pay for it. The U.S. taxpayer is. And so, you know, those two things that are just consistently needed to put together a legislative strategy to get something like this done, both the political capital to get it done, the support from the public, and also support from Congress, he just doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. I would note, Ben, in addition, that we can tell how serious this is by whether or not there will be cameras present during the whole negotiation. If, in fact, the cameras are there for the whole process, it's political optics. It's not serious negotiation. If they maybe have their couple of shots, pool reporters, whatever, and then they go somewhere and talk out of the view and sound of the cameras, then there maybe will be some serious negotiation.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of this? A good point there, Kedren, on you know, Mexico in the campaigning. How many times was it said that Mexico would be paying for the wall? That obviously evolving, but then we have more recent questions about what is a wall. This from the outgoing White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly. He gave an excellent interview to the Los Angeles Times and admitted the border wall, this signature promised by Mr. Trump during the campaign, isn't really a wall. Here is his quote from the Los Angeles Times exclusive interview. "To be honest, it's not a wall. The president still says wall. Often, sometimes, frankly, he'll say barrier or fencing. Now he's tended toward steel slats, but we left a solid concrete wall early on in the administration when we asked people what they needed and where they needed it." Kedren, could that be the solution here? You know, not saying border wall, saying border security, because we know, don't we, that Democrats are certainly not against border security as much as the president would like people to think they are.
Yeah, I guess that could be a solution. And if Dennis is right that they may go behind closed doors and try to figure out a win-win scenario for both of them, that might be what emerges. I'm just struck by how much better of a deal he probably could have gotten last year. There were 54 senators who voted for the DACA deal, mm-hmm. which included, I think it was $2.5 billion a year for 10 years for various measures in border security, and Trump is the one who backed out at the last minute and basically undermined the deal. So, again, I'm just emphasizing this fact that his leverage is gone, and so I'm not sure what point he's negotiating from, other than maybe to say to his supporters, his core supporters, well, I got you something that is like a wall, even if it's not, you know, a 20-foot concrete wall.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, how do you see this playing out? We have the meeting today, both parties meeting at the White House Situation Room. Where do you suspect this will go? Do you see a compromise? Do you see the Democrats willing to make any sort of compromise now?
Well, as Kevin noted, and you noted as well, what this is about is border security. And it's not an unreasonable argument to say that any country should have secure borders. And a wall is simply a means to that end. Now, the president has identified the two. The only way you get border security is a wall, depending upon what the meaning of wall is. And the Democrats should be, from their perspective, arguing that their goal, too, is border security, but they believe that a wall is wasted spending and will not, in fact, solve the problem. But they haven't been making that case very well. So the question then is, how well do the Democrats play their hand in this particular case? I think one of the shutdowns almost a year ago, the Democrats didn't play their hand very well. But at the same time, the president showed when he rejected the bill that came out of the Senate, encouraged the House when they had the Republican majority to support him in this regard. He's terrified of commentators like Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh. And so they've held his feet to the fire in terms of his most extreme positions. So the question is whether he's willing to stand up to their pressure, which is very hard line with regard to a wall. And so far, he has not shown that he's willing to stand up to their pressure.
Mm-hmm. So let's step into tomorrow when the Democratic Party takes control of the U.S. House. We'll get our first taste of a divided government in the Trump era, the Senate and the White House under Republican control, the U.S. House under the control of the Democrats after having won. This has changed somewhat, but I think, what, 40-seat swing, right? Something like that. Significant swing in the midterm elections of last year. Representative Nancy Pelosi likely to be elected Speaker of the House tomorrow. She has said her first order of business would be reopening the government, which has been shut down for 12 days, partially over this spending impasse over a border wall. And Pelosi has said that the wall can't be part of any deal. We'll see how that goes out. But when we talk about the agenda of the Democrats, Kedren, what do you expect? Let's sort of take the legislation first and deal with oversight and investigations second. But what is high on the Democrats' list in terms of legislative accomplishments do you expect?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. They've had a few documents that evidently were leaked. Parts of them were leaked out, indicating what their agenda would be right when they got in. The three things that I saw mentioned repeatedly were, number one, working to actually get an infrastructure bill passed, possibly a $1 trillion infrastructure bill over any number of years. We used to joke about the infrastructure week. You know, every week was infrastructure week when the Trump administration was promising us that we'd get something done on that. I think Democrats will start with a slightly more bipartisan agenda, infrastructure, maybe working with Trump on something to reduce prescription drug costs. And the other thing that you see emphasized by the Democrats in the Congress and as well as some of the candidates for 2020, they've been talking a lot about government ethics or political ethics, political reform. And so I would expect them to roll out a larger package related to anything from, you know, requiring presidents to release their tax returns, presidential candidates to release their tax returns, to better disclosure of dark money in politics. So I think they'll start more bipartisan. I think they're going to have to move fairly quickly away from that because the composition of the Democratic caucus has actually changed after the election, and they will have to move fairly quickly, I think, to some of the issues that the base cares about more.
Dennis, what do you have to add to the legislative agenda of the Democrats?
Leaving aside the fact that, of course, you can't legislate from one house of Congress. You've got to have the Senate, the other house, and the president, so that's problematic. But the average person doesn't really care about process questions. This is not to say they're not important. The sorts of things Kedren mentioned are absolutely important. But I think in terms of the Democrats' agenda, one of the things they need to ask themselves what's going to make a meaningful, concrete difference in the everyday lives of the average American. And those process issues are not going to make, whether the president releases tax returns or not, that won't in and of itself make a meaningful difference in the average person's life. So the infrastructure bill that Kedren mentioned would certainly seem to do that. At the same time, you know, one of the fundamental roles of the U.S. Congress is to come up with a budget every year, and we've not been able to see that in quite a number of years, if not decades. So that's a big problem. If they could get themselves, as John McCain used to say, back to regular order and procedures in that regard, that would help. But there's also the question of the Republican tax returns having blown a hole in the budget. You know, there's a huge deficit. Republicans complained about deficits under President Obama. Those were just a walk in the sunshine compared to what's coming under the Republican deficits. And then finally, the concern, and I think the Democrats will be, and I think Republicans to some extent will be as well, but the dispute over who would get credit for fixing the problem, is the apparently weakening economy. And that's certainly the market, I think, dropped 350 points this morning, the Dow, within minutes of its opening. So that's also a concern for people.
Dennis Goldford is with us. If you just joined us, of Drake University, Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College in Indianola, our political scientist on board for this very first Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. If you'd like to join us specifically to talk about the Democrats taking control of the House, what would you like to see as the Democrats take control of the U.S. House. We have to remember here in Iowa, Iowa was part of the swing toward the Democrats with Abby Finkenauer and Cindy Axne taking over previously held House seats by Republicans, now in Democrats' hands. I happened to run into the most veteran member of Congress in Iowa yesterday, Congressman Dave Loebsack of the 2nd District, asked what he was looking forward to. He said finding middle ground with the GOP to pass meaningful legislation was his answer. I wonder, though, Dennis, can we expect from the Democrats all that sort of well-meaning talk there to be put aside and to be somewhat obstructionist in the run-up to 2020? It would serve their purposes, right? I mean, instead of handing the president a lot of bipartisan victories, if that was able to be accomplished.
Just as we had an awful lot of extremely angry Republicans come into office in January 1995 after that big Republican sweep in the election of 1994, we have an awful lot of extremely angry Democrats coming back into the House after the election we just had in November. So that's the question about whether, in fact, they will want to vent their anger and talk about things like impeachment and just pursue investigations of the Trump administration to the disadvantage of doing anything meaningful with regard to concrete policy accomplishments. That's an argument within the Democratic Party now between perhaps the more centrist aspect of the party and the more Bernie Sanders, more liberal populist wing of the party, progressive populist wing of the party. There, I think, again, is a concern. You know, you had a case in which Republicans, when they controlled both houses, didn't want to give President Obama any victories that he could claim for his credit, especially going into reelection. Democrats may not want to give any victories to the Trump administration that they could use. So we just don't know yet how this will work out. And we have to remember finally that, as somebody else put it, but I thought it was very accurate, President Trump has not governed as president of the United States. He's governed as president of his base. Republicans were concerned very early on that he would work in a bipartisan way with Democrats. He showed, at least at the time, that he might talk it, but he didn't get to the point of doing it. So we don't know at this point what he's willing to do.
Join our conversation with Dennis Goldford and Kedrin Bardwell. What do you would you like to see from Democrats as they take control of the U.S. House? 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Kedrin, weigh in on this other action that we anticipate from Congress, the oversight, the investigations. There are so many investigations. It would take a minute or two to list them, simply list them. Where do you see the Democrats going, and will they be doing that in unison, in agreement?
Well, I think the background for this is that, as I said, the caucus has changed somewhat. One of the statistics that I thought was most interesting regarding this last election was to look back and see the composition of the caucus and how it's changed. If you go back to only, say, 2010, there were about 80 members of the so-called Progressive Democratic Caucus, which is the block of the most liberal members of the House. But there were 54 members of the Blue Dogs, which is the conservative Democrats in the House. Move on to lead up to the 2020 elections, and now we've got, with the Democratic victory, about 100 members of the Progressive Caucus. And now, since many of the moderate to conservative Democrats have either left the House or been beaten, we now only have 24 Blue Dogs. So we've gone from, you know, having a relatively broad Democratic Party ideologically to one that's going to be much more narrowly focused on the issues that the liberal base cares about. And that's going to affect the way that these hearings and investigations roll out. I think they'll be much more aggressive. I don't think they'll be able to convince the leadership to move on impeachment. I think the leaders have essentially said to their members that they're not going to do that unless they can find some realistic chance that that would be a somewhat bipartisan process and that they could bring over at least a few Republicans to their side.
Meaning Pelosi has repeated this, right?
Yeah, I mean that's essentially the signal from the leadership, and you've had a few other members of leadership also do interviews where they'd signal something like this, that they just don't think impeachment is likely, or, you know, why do it if you are just going to be rebuffed by the Senate anyway. And so I think that's the problem they're fighting here is, you know, what does the base want? What can the leadership actually accomplish? And so in that sense, you know, you're deciding how much is a legislative agenda versus how much is basically a blueprint. It's a blueprint for what we will want and what we will do if we get unified control of the government after 2020. So a lot of these moves the Democrats might make may not actually result in anything. That is, the Senate will reject them, or Trump would even veto them if the Senate passed them. But it's setting up a blueprint and an agenda for the Democrats post-2020.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the big wild card in 2019 is the Mueller report. Dennis, we have to believe, I think, that in 2019 that will be issued. I suppose it's possible it wouldn't be. Investigations have gone on longer, but we're assuming the 2019, right?
We would think so. I mean, it certainly has gone on for quite a while, and they've been very, very good about running a leak-proof operation. So we simply don't know what's there. Now, the question is also whether, in fact, Acting Attorney General, Iowa native Matt Whitaker, will do anything to short-circuit that investigation. So far, he apparently has not. So if that's left to run, that, of course, is one of the most salient and important political factors out there in the environment that will help determine what happens in 2019.
Mm-hmm. What is your view, Dennis, on what Kedren was talking about, whether and when, if it would be strategically important for the Democrats at any time to go in impeachment? Do they have to have GOP leaders jump on board, both in the House and the Senate here, or at least have a change of mind and not back Trump to the degree they have in this past year?
Well, the question is, do you want to vent some anger just for the sake of venting some anger, even knowing it's not going to go anywhere? Or do you want to be more strategic and say this is a move to make when there really is a strong possibility of its being successful? Because the House can vote impeachment, but as we saw with President Clinton, whether one agrees or disagrees with the set of charges, it lost in the Senate. So, yeah, you could say President X, in this case President Trump, had impeachment and voted in the House but was not convicted in the Senate. So you've expended all that energy and anger and ginned up the whole political environment even more than it is, which is already just exhausting for us who observe it, but end up with nothing, or whether, in fact, you want to wait until the Mueller investigation finally finishes, and maybe there would be something that would be a step too far on the part of the Trump administration for even Republicans in the Senate.
We'll be back in just a moment with more from Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College on this Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll talk about the news that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren will visit Iowa this weekend, holding events in Council Bluffs, Sioux City, Storm Lake, and Des Moines. She's launched an exploratory committee for 2020, her presidential bid. That happened New Year's Eve. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back with more from Dennis Goldford, Kedren Bardwell. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
And we're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Kedren Bardwell, professor and chair of political science at Simpson College in Indianola, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. And if you'd like to join our conversation as we chew over the politics on Wednesday's politics show, the very first time of 2019, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at Iowa Public Radio. .org. Well, Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Democrat, in her first term, is entering the 2020 presidential race. She made her announcement on Monday, becoming the first major candidate that, in what is likely, we can say pretty safely, to be a crowded primary. Former Vice President Joe Biden expected to reveal early this year whether he plans to make what will be a third bid for the presidency. Let's listen to a little bit of what Elizabeth Warren had to say in an email to supporters. She included a link to a biographical video slamming Republican policies and outlining her vision.
We can make our democracy work for all of us. We can make our economy work for all of us. We can rebuild America's middle class. But this time, we gotta build it for everyone. No matter where you live in America, and no matter where your family came from in the world, you deserve a path to opportunity. Because no matter what our differences, most of us want the same thing, to be able to work hard, play by the same set of rules, and take care of the people we love. That's the America I'm fighting for. And that's why today I'm launching an exploratory committee for president. But the outcome of this election will depend on you. In the last 2 years, millions of people have done more than they ever thought they would to protect the promise of America. And here's what we learned. If we organize together, if we fight together, if we persist together, we can win. We can and we will.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, in announcing her exploratory committee for 2020 presidential election, that was on New Year's Eve. President Trump responded to the news in an interview on Fox News. Here's part of it.
Elizabeth Warren will be the first. She did very badly in proving that she was of Indian heritage. That didn't work out too well. I think you have more than she does, and maybe I do too, and I have nothing. So, you know, we'll see how she does. I wish her well. I hope she does well. I'd love to run against her.
She says she's in the fight all the way, Mr. President. Do you really think she believes she can win?
Well, that I don't know. You'd have to ask her psychiatrist.
Okay, the president speaking in reaction to the announcement by Senator Warren that she's forming that exploratory committee. Kedren, how do you size up Elizabeth Warren as a candidate and the timing, the early announcement here, I guess we could say, on New Year's Eve?
Well, I'm not going to read too much into the timing. That's a strategic decision by the campaign, but I think we can evaluate where she stands vis-a-vis some of the previous contenders we've seen. She's a senator, which brings with it great name recognition, usually at least a little more than most candidates have nationally. At the same time, being a senator puts you open to people picking apart your legislative votes over the years, and so a lot of times that's used against senators when they run for president. Her basic message seems to be about, you know, income inequality, fairness, about you know, protecting Americans from some of the downsides of globalization. So that message, I think, actually can resonate fairly well with not just Democrats nationally, but Iowa Democrats in particular. The question is whether she is the right messenger for that. I think she got wrapped up in some of this, you know, hand-to-hand combat with Trump earlier on in the administration. And I think to some extent what we've learned from the Trump, the record, is that when people get dragged into that kind of person-on-person battle with Trump, they rarely come out looking better.
Mm-hmm. The progressive side of the Democratic Party, in a surprise, I guess a surprise to a lot of analysts in the last election cycle for president in 2016, Bernie Sanders coming out of almost nowhere. Dennis, do you see Elizabeth Warren here sharing that agenda, that progressive banner, and perhaps splitting the vote?
Well, it depends, number one, upon who else enters and seeks to hold that banner high. I mean, she completely says things that just thrill the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But as Kedren noted, I think she comes in at least a somewhat damaged candidate, because she validated the president's snarky nickname for her by doing a DNA test. That just played right into his attacks on her. So that was politically and strategically clumsy in doing that. But there's no doubt that she says things that just thrill the progressive wing of the party.
Mm-hmm. Just mentioning Elizabeth Warren to visit Iowa this weekend. Events announced by her campaign in Council Bluffs, Sioux City, Storm Lake, and Des Moines. And join us if you'd like to tell us what are your thoughts on the field of Democratic candidates, presumably to face the Republican nominee Donald Trump again in 2016. Kedren, do we see any, I know there have been rumblings, do we need a serious challenge to the president for the nomination in 2020?
You know, I actually don't expect one in the end. I think there's been overtures put out there by people like Governor Kasich in Ohio, even anyone like Jeff Flake, who recently retired from the Senate, one of Trump's main critics in the Senate on the Republican side, has at least said he's considering or thinking. I don't see any serious challenge to Trump, and there's actually been some efforts by some of the state parties, state GOP organizations, to try to preemptively shut down any opposition, and we'll see if that goes anywhere. But, you know, one of the things, and we'll talk about this later, you know, what are your takeaways from the year? But the idea of this total Trump takeover of the GOP, I think it's essentially been crystallized and come to fruition in 2018. Most of the people that would otherwise be his opponents, some of the moderates in the party, have either left or been booted out. And so that's why we hear, you know, almost this total silence from Republicans now in terms of even some of the most controversial things the president says or does.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones. Kedron Bardwell with us and Dennis Goldford, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's go to Jim in Iowa City. Jim, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us on this Politics Wednesday.
Thank you very much for taking my call. The question earlier was about what can Democrats do when they come into power this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, kind of going on some of the comments earlier, that, yeah, there were a lot of angry Republicans after the Republican takeover in 95, 96. And we have a group of new, energized, very energized, perhaps angry might be a good word for the some of the Democrats coming into office this year, which is a good thing, but I think the country has grown tired of shouting each other. I've got this feeling that people have realized that shouting is not accomplishing anything, and we're starting to get some sort of sense that bipartisan compromise might be the way to go. And I think our biggest challenge is going to be tempering the new anger with a big desire for bipartisan compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's going to work, I don't know, but I think that's going to be the biggest challenge.
Okay, Jim in Iowa City, thank you for your thoughts. Yeah, of course, every election cycle, every 4 years for a presidential election, Dennis has a new sort of turf, and the people playing on that turf are always trying to determine what do the voters want, right? And this sort of Trumpian rhetoric we had really sold well among a lot of voters last time.
I go back to my fearsome threesome, which is cable TV, the talk radio, and social media. And they exist to fan outrage, anger, fear. And you may say that the average American is tired of all this and wants some sort of compromise or bipartisanship, but those three particular institutions operate in a way constantly to throw gasoline on any kind of fire that might be burning.
You don't see that changing?
No.
Okay. Jerry, one of our listeners, writes to us, the Democrats need to include in their position for a deal on the wall a requirement for a pay raise for federal workers. The Democrats have traditionally been a defender of the middle class, but Obama abandoned the public service workers. If Dems want to regain power, they need to include all middle class in their base, including federal workers. Recall that Border Guards and TSA and Coast Guard are all federal workers and critical to border security. Give them a pay raise, writes Jerry, one of our listeners. Let's see, where do we go from here? Let's go back to talking about some of the other candidates. Kedron, what's a candidate we haven't mentioned? There are certainly plenty of them that you expect to get in this race. Joe Biden, leading in almost all the opinion polls, a recent poll here in Iowa. Joe Biden coming out on top, right?
Yeah, I think this early, obviously, we speak with a lot of caution about what any poll will tell us, but they do absolutely track name recognition and who's visible and who's already known. And you can get a decent sense as name recognition increases for each of these candidates, also what their general favorability is. You know, Biden, for example, has fairly high favorability and has actually decent numbers among independents as well. In contrast, someone like Warren, as she's increased her visibility, has actually gone underwater in favorability a bit, even as she's become more known. So that's the kind of dance we're looking at in terms of some of the polling early on. Now, Iowa is certainly a different kind of ball game, given that the types of campaigning that happen here are different than what happens in some larger states. So I'm interested to see how the field winnows, that is, how many of these candidates that we're talking about now as potential candidates, as more people get in, do they decide, well, that person overlaps too much with, you know, the type of message that I would present, or they could carry that message instead, particularly the large number of, you know, senators and governors who are thinking about this. You know, if a major candidate like Biden or then maybe Sanders gets in, how many of the other candidates say, well, that's good enough for me, or do they say, well, I'm the only one that can bring that message, you know, Kamala Harris or Cory Booker, do they say, well, the establishment candidates we've put up in the past haven't worked, and therefore we need something new.
Dennis, should we? You literally wrote the book on the Iowa caucuses. To tell us how we should think about this going forward. I have this picture, perhaps a false picture, of like the NBA brackets going forward, and one league has in those brackets is a progressive wing and then a moderate wing, and first you decide who is the head of the progressives, who is the head of the moderates, and then they duke it out.
Well, I believe in 2015, some people actually talked in terms of brackets, and certainly on the Republican side, people talked in terms of who owns or who's traveling in what particular lane. However, when Donald Trump came in and things got going, he just basically concreted over the whole highway. I mean, it just didn't, it wasn't worth talking about lanes anymore. So as Kadrin said, this is extremely early. I mean, John Delaney's been here for a year already and wants to do Jimmy Carter 2.0 in terms of talking with, you know, everyday people on a small retail basis as opposed to the big mass rallies and things like that, if he could even get a mass rally at this point. But no, we're in exhibition season when everybody's a contender. And again, I think we'll know by late spring, early summer, who the realistic candidates are. But we won't know until then.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we'll be talking about many of the issues that these candidates are talking about, too. On this Politics Wednesday, we sort of talk about the political machinery going on in our country. Dennis Goldford with us and Kendrin Bardwell. Let's dive to one aspect of foreign policy before we get into your wrapping up thoughts about the year of politics that was in 2018. The administration officials said on Monday that President Trump has agreed to give the military about 4 months to withdraw from, these are about 2,000 U.S. troops, from Syria. This is backtracking from his abrupt order that we remember from a couple weeks ago that the military had about 30 days to pull out. This is a Donald Trump tweet recent about this topic. If anybody but Donald Trump did what I did in Syria, which was an ISIS-loaded mess when I became president, they would be a national hero. Continuing to write in this tweet, ISIS is mostly gone. We're slowly sending our troops back home to be with their families, while at the same time fighting ISIS remnants. Now, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican senator, South Carolina, once an outspoken critic of the president's decision to withdraw troops from Syria, spoke with reporters after a meeting at the White House on this past Monday. Senator Graham said he felt much better about the direction we're headed in Syria.
So the president assured me that he's going to make sure he gets the job done, and I assured him that nobody has done more to defeat ISIS than he has. We're inside the 10-yard line. Then you got the Kurds that we need to be concerned about. They stepped up when nobody else would, and he's very aware of that problem. He's going to be talking to Turkey about assuring Turkey that they will have a buffer zone that they need, given their concerns about the YPG Kurds. But the last thing in the world we want is a war between Turkey and the Kurds. That takes pressure off ISIS. And the last thing we want, in addition to that, is Iran to be the big winner here. So I think the president's going to finish the job when it comes to ISIS. I share his goal to withdraw our forces from Syria. I just want to do it in a smart way.
Okay, Senator Lindsey Graham, what would you say, Kedrin, playing a moderating role there, evolving the president's abrupt order into something different?
Yeah, I think that's what Graham is doing, and he's looking at the realities of what the generals and what foreign policy establishment's telling him, and that kind of precipitous withdrawal would just be a disaster, not just for the U.S. and its objectives in the region, but for groups like the Kurds that are probably, as we withdraw, going to have to be fighting against incursions by Turkey, trying to wipe them off the face of the earth. So, this is interesting. The Syria pullout, I mean, don't forget how important this is in terms of the Mattis resignation. That was a really startling thing to happen to any president. But it really kind of shows how the president operates in these types of areas. This isn't his strength. He's not a foreign policy wonk. He basically wants to say, I succeeded. Let's declare victory and be done. But it's revealing some of the weaknesses in his foreign policy decision making. He did this basically without talking to our allies about it and how they would be impacted in the region. He seemed to take and give more credence to what the president of Turkey thought about this than even some of our allies. And so when Mattis resigned, that very critical letter was pointing out, this is dangerous, a dangerous way to go about foreign policy making, even implying that Trump was not really being, quote, clear-eyed about who our enemies were. So, Syria itself, we'll kind of have to see what happens and how this more drawn-out withdrawal affects the region. But I think it really illustrates the way that Trump makes foreign policy decisions in this kind of rash manner.
Couple minutes left, and we certainly want to get both of your views on 2018, not leaving you much time to do it, but let me turn to you, Dennis Goldford. Considering the year of politics, so much happened in politics in 2018. Which of the political stories of 2018 do you have your eye on as far as having the ripples into 2019 and having the most import?
Well, I'd point to three things that will be continuing factors. The Mueller investigation, the Democratic takeover of the House, which we'll see as of Thursday, and then finally the threat, if not reality yet, of a weakening economy. I think those developed throughout and then especially toward the end of 2018, and I think at this point, barring other unexpected factors, those will be the chief factors going forward.
Mm-hmm. Kedren, is that your list? Do you have to amend or add to get to your list?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with most of those. I'd add one positive story and one negative story. I think we can't ignore this record turnout we had in the midterm. Yeah. I mean, if you talked to Dennis or myself 15 years ago and said we'd have 50% plus turnout in a midterm election, we might have even, as people who promote civic engagement, we might have said you're crazy. This is the highest turnout in a midterm election in a congressional election since 1914. So that's a huge positive, and just the idea of getting people at least engaged on that basic level is great for American politics. The negative story, and we're maybe missing this as some of these, week-to-week crises, we're missing some of the longer-term crises, and Dennis mentioned this earlier, the trillion-dollar deficits, and even more than that as we move into the future. We have both parties that have basically neglected and failed to provide solutions to the long-term budget issues that relate to entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and other spending. And so I think those are the one positive and one negative story I'd take out of 2018 and we'll have to deal with in the future.
Right. And what did I see from, I think, the U.S. Election Project at University of Florida? You mentioned over 50% turnout in the 2018 midterm election, higher, according to this project, than at any time since 1914. That is huge. And the record number of women running and winning in the midterm election, including Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer here in Iowa, a record number of women serving in state legislatures as well. We're up to 29% from 25% of all state-level seats across the country. Specifically, Dennis, on the case of women, how do you see more women, regardless of what party they're in this case, overwhelmingly Democrats mostly, joining the new ranks of women in Congress? How do you see women's influence changing the actual politics, the issues, the legislation?
Well, Democratic women tend to have a more feminist approach to things, at least as I've seen it in the past. So they would be particularly concerned about what they consider distinctly women's issues. On the Republican side, at least, again, based upon what we've seen up to now, I would suggest that Republican women have seen themselves as Republicans first and women second. And so they tend to pursue more standard Republican and conservative kinds of issues. I think of Martha Blackburn, elected recent, just this past November, to the Senate from Tennessee. Governor Reynolds, again, if you go to rallies and listen to her speeches, pursues standard Republican issues.
All right. We have to go. Thank you very much for starting off 2019 with another Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldfer, professor and chair of political science at Drake University in Des Moines. Kedrin Bardwell, professor and chair of political science at Simpson College in Indianola. What a year we have in front of us. Kedrin and Dennis, I'm so glad that we have you to turn to for analysis. Thank you both for turning up today.
Quite welcome.
Thanks. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year again. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can contact us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.